This is ContactTalkRadio.com, consciousness in action, and you are taking action into your consciousness by tuning into Contact Talk Radio.
And on TuneIn.com, Hing.fm, and Upsnap Mobile.
Contact Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Madeira Show, where he will discuss testosterone, optimization, and full body health for the high-performance modern man. Now, here's your host, Dr. Madeira.
Hello, everybody. It's Dr. Madeira back here on my show today, and we have special guest Todd Eluzio back on the show from Two Bear Farm. How's it going today, Todd?
Great. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. And we're recording today, mid-April 2020, during the whole novel coronavirus pandemic. And you're still trucking away over there at Two Bear Farm, doing your thing and starting up the growing season. I saw the other day you were spreading on Instagram, you had a video with the compost spreader. And so everything's gearing up on your end of things. Yeah. Last time we spoke, we were talking about regenerative agriculture, why people should eat organic. And this time we wanted to talk a little bit more about Roundup and how Roundup gets maybe too much of the limelight. How do you want to approach that with the audience? What do you have to say about Roundup and the ins and outs there?
I guess I'd like to start kind of maybe at a higher, kind of broader context, just right off the bat. I believe that there's a tendency for people who are concerned with human and ecosystem health to harshly criticize the industrial food system, and rightly so, and Roundup often comes up as sort of the poster child for that. But I feel like a lot of times that sort of concern gets directly at conventional farmers without always understanding their situation and the bigger industry that's influencing them to farm the way they do. And I just wanted to bring up the point that as a farmer, I try to be a farmer advocate for all farmers. And no one likes to be criticized, and no one likes to be told what they're doing wrong, why it's bad. I think any human would agree that it's not their favorite way to learn. And so I think in the polarized world we live in, when we criticize someone we don't agree with, that person typically doesn't change their minds, right? Typically they get upset, they dig their heels in, and they lose respect for you, which actually hinders us getting the change that we're looking for. And I say that because I think people in America, where less than 1% of us are farmers anymore, we're pretty disconnected from farming. And it's easy to criticize the average conventional farmer for his or her use of chemicals. But I think we should understand that for them, that's what they've learned from day one. You know, if you want to be a farmer in America, whether you join 4-H or FFA, maybe you study VOAG in high school, maybe you choose to study agriculture at a land-grant university, you're bombarded from day one with the idea that industrial systems are the only way and the right way to grow crops, right? You're taught about antibiotics, you're talking about feeding grain to cattle, you're taught about synthetic inputs, herbicides, insecticides, fungicides, right? That's the truth that you learn from the experts that are in your sphere of influence. So, you know, as a farmer, you're out on the landscape, you're surrounded by a community of like-minded farmers, you're all buying your seed and your fertilizers and your chemicals from the same local dealer that also buys your crop at the end of the year. And they're constantly telling you that this is the right way to farm, right? And you should be proud because you're feeding the world. So I think when like along comes a healthcare provider or a concerned consumer or maybe another farmer, and we tell that farmer what they're doing is wrong. It's bad for human health. It's bad for the soil. The chemicals are a poison. You know, we tend to get a strong negative response because they don't know you. They don't interact with you on a daily basis like they do their neighbors, right? And here we are, we're criticizing how they farm. And so just that cautionary statement of like, that approach often promotes more division, and it can tend to lack understanding and compassion for the context that conventional farmers operate in, right? This use of chemicals, this industrial mindset, it's a systemic problem. It's not just specific to farmers making bad choices. And so the reason I bring that up, listening to some podcasts lately, I feel like Roundup, there's lots of issues with chemicals in agriculture, but we've begun to just use Roundup as sort of the catch-all for all the problems. And my fear with that is there's plenty to criticize regarding Roundup. But if we are making errors in what we're saying about it, we leave ourselves open to criticism, and we can be discredited. The focus shifts to our error more than to the topic we're trying to discuss, right? So when we get the facts wrong, that's a big deal. And so we talked in the last podcast a little bit about glyphosate. You know, what is it? Is it on everything? It's certainly showing up in the environment a lot. But in this last podcast I was listening to, there was talk of, you know, the toxic load, this chronic exposure to chemicals by people, especially kids. They were talking about using glyphosate, you know, Roundup on your lawns. And when you go to the park, it's on the grass. And I cringed a little bit because glyphosate is a non-selective herbicide. It kills everything, including grass. It's why it's used in no-till agriculture for chemical fallow. You would never put Roundup on your lawn unless you wanted a dead lawn. You would use some other herbicide. You'd use a like 2,4-D, which is a broadleaf herbicide. Kills broadleaf weeds, but it doesn't kill grass. Therefore, you can have this pure monoculture green lawn, right? But if we start saying, oh, our town is using Roundup in the parks, right? It leaves us open a little bit for criticism that we don't know what we're talking about, right? And I think the more we understand about it, when we do talk to food producers or we talk to the county park about what they're using in our town, the more we understand, the more respect that they will give us, that we've taken the time to learn what we're talking about, rather than just saying Roundup all the time. So kind of a tangent there, but I know Roundup has come up in our discussions quite a bit. And I think it's important for people to know that at this point in time, most Roundup that we encounter as consumers is coming from commodity crops that are processed into other food items. So like your corn, sugar beets, soybeans. You can't really use Roundup directly on a food item unless it's been genetically modified to be resistant to Roundup. You can spray it before the crop is in the ground, right? You can spray Roundup on soil to kill the weeds before you plant. But once a crop is up and growing, the only way to really spray it with Roundup, it would have to be GMO resistant, what would be called Roundup ready. There's a couple exceptions to that, which are big exceptions, and it happens with wheat and barley. If you spray Roundup on wheat and barley, there are no GMO varieties that have been approved of those yet. But what you achieve right before harvest, if you have a wheat field that has inconsistent maturity, it doesn't feed through the combine that's harvesting it very well, right? The green stems clog up the combine. And so there's this process called desiccation where farmers will spray this mature wheat crop with Roundup in order to uniformly dry down the wheat crop so that it goes through the combine. The issue with that is you're spraying Roundup on the wheat right before it's going to the consumer, right? And you had brought up in the past beverages and the issue with that. I think that's where it comes into play, right? When we're talking about wheat and barley, the use of Roundup for desiccation. Doesn't mean all beers have this issue, but some of them certainly do. I feel like organic foods get a lot of attention, but for some reason our beverages don't. You know, even if you go to a health food store, most of the beers that are there are not made with organic products. Very hard to find an organic beer. I mean, I've been to organic farming conferences and everybody's sitting around drinking PBR, right? We have a big organic dinner and then everybody's drinking conventional beer afterwards. Kind of a big disconnect.
Yeah, that is a huge disconnect. And I think most people, most consumers, everyday people, the general public doesn't even know that beer and wine could have this herbicide in it that could be detrimental to their gut microbiome and their overall health, and especially if they have a family history of breast cancer for women and other cancers, that this should be a real big concern. So, I mean, even if somebody is eating all organic vegetables, mostly grain-free, organic meats, and like you said, they're drinking a glass of wine that isn't organic throughout their days of the week, then they could be exposing themselves to a carcinogen. Although the powers that be seem to have, and this is my opinion, I haven't yet found research to back this up, but as far as a lot of these herbicides and pesticides, and Roundup being a herbicide, are not being found to show through the research from the large research studies that they have done to prove carcinogenicity. So if you're, you know, of the research mind and you're a scientist, or you believe in science being pure and untainted by big corporations' special interests, unfortunately, that's not the world we live in. The world we live in is that the science is completely funded by these big corporations. And I'm leaving out names on purpose, but maybe hopefully the listeners can read between the lines. And unbeknownst to me, I haven't been able to find true proof besides the trials where people who were actually groundskeepers or working with actually spraying Roundup or pest herbicides rather on the ground that developed lymphomas and were already on their way, you know, they're already dying from the lymphoma. Those trials, those big trials where you see in the media from 2018 and maybe early 2019, where they were, you know, there's a groundskeeper in the North San Francisco Bay Area where it was almost $300 million that he won in this case. And apparently that's the value of his life from spraying these chemicals. And besides that, there doesn't seem to be a lot of so-called scientific evidence where people are basically saying this is, it's not generally recognized as safe. You know, it's not like drinking, you know, water, even though water has its problems too. But it's not like eating lettuce or something like that. It's, you know, obviously toxic, but as long as you're not spraying it on your skin as a farmer, or exposed to it in the air as a farmer, you're basically safe is the message that the USDA has given the general public. What do you have to say to that? And is there any other research out there that I haven't found, or maybe our listeners haven't heard of, or evidence that you've heard of from conferences you've been to say otherwise?
I think the big issue we have with research is we think, as Americans, we think of it as, well, that's the truth. but we don't realize how much bias there is in research regarding what questions are asked and which questions are not asked. And so in the case of the use of herbicides, most of the research is coming from the companies that are manufacturing the herbicides, and they are picking the questions that they are going to research. When that gets handed off to the EPA for approval, typically the EPA is not doing any of their own research, and they're not looking for third-party research. They are just looking at the chemical company's research and signing off on that as valid, and therefore backing that industry that they're supposed to be regulating. They're actually more like promoting their findings and then claiming that, yep, sure, Roundup glyphosate is in fact harmless. But I don't know of any study that's been conducted that looks at chronic exposure of Roundup to humans. How does it affect the gut biome? What about the fact that glyphosate, the main chemical in Roundup, is a chelator, and that's what it was developed for? If you're chronically ingesting a chelator in your diet, what effect is that having on human health? I would guarantee you there's no research on the topic. Does that mean it's harmless? No. It means they're not asking the right questions. And I think that's really misleading. I think farmers are in the same boat where they've been told Roundup is harmless. Within 3 days, it breaks down and disappears. And so I think there's a lot of farmers who use it who truly believe that it is harmless. The interesting thing, and you brought up the lawsuits, Monsanto developed Roundup. And then I believe it was just last year, Bayer Pharmaceutical bought Monsanto. Almost immediately, those three lawsuits came up, which were the first lawsuits that the chemical companies had lost. They lost all three, and the juries had some really huge awards, multi-million-dollar awards. And I know the shareholders at Bayer were really incensed that they had lost more money in those three lawsuits than they had kind of gained by buying Monsanto. And they're at a point now where Bayer is actually trying to negotiate a global settlement. There's over 75,000 people suing Monsanto or Bayer over Roundup at this point. And they've lost the first three, and they see the exposure, and they're trying to come up with a global settlement somewhere around $10 billion. But what's absurd about that is they're saying it's harmless, but they're willing to pay $10 billion. And after the global settlement, they want to be able to continue to sell glyphosate on the open market. And while all this is going on, the EPA in this country just approved the license for Roundup or for glyphosate for another 13 years. So it's been approved to be used for the next 13 years as well. And so, you know, where's the truth? Like, where did these 75,000 people come from? And why do they all believe Roundup is an issue? And why are companies willing to pay them, yet they're not willing to admit that there's issues with their products?
Yeah, there's a lot of incongruency there in their messaging as a corporation, and basically shows their general disregard for humanity and humanity's health. And basically they're all for their profits, and as the corporations are protecting their shareholders. Also, Bayer has a very dark history going back to Nazi Germany. It had another corporation named then. And
IG Farben.
Yes. And they were part of the basically human experiments on the people in the concentration camps, which were people who were mentally retarded, homosexuals, Jewish people. And a lot of the things that we know about what humans can tolerate for like lethal dose, LD50, if you go into look at any medication on drugs.com or something like that, for these very toxic older prescriptions and other medical experiments come from their experiments in the concentration camps of medical experiments. So it's a pretty tattered past, and I think that's putting it lightly for Bayer. And even Bayer aspirin, the baby aspirin, has come into question over the last 3 or more years as to its efficacy clinically and if baby aspirin actually even prevents cardiac events in the outcome research. And I mean, you can just look at the numbers. We're almost losing 700,000 people every year to cardiovascular disease every 37 seconds. Somebody dies from heart disease in the United States, and or heart attack or stroke. So cerebral vascular diseases in that category. So this is a real issue that Bayer, Monsanto conglomerate, basically, I mean, it's like the Michael Jackson song. I mean, they don't care about us is kind of what I think about. And I really think there's been a great marketing campaign from the big agricultural chemical companies. Mostly Monsanto is the one that most of us think about right off the bat. And basically telling people that GMO crops, as we mentioned in the last time we spoke on the podcast, are going to save the world from world hunger. We're going to make so much food. We're going to grow so much food and deliver so much food to the world. And that's going to be life-saving for all these people and third world countries that need our food. And the reports, even from the NGOs, are that most of these people either A, aren't getting the food because of the corruption with NGOs, and B, are scared of the food because they don't trust the American food supply.
Well, I think it comes back to the idea of feeding the world is the phrase that gets used over and over again. The problem is that we grow plenty of food in this world. We grow enough food in this on the planet to feed 14 billion people. And there's only 7.5 billion of us roughly at the moment. So it's not the quantity that's ever been the issue, it's the distribution. And so to say we need to increase yields doesn't make sense when we're already overproducing. You add to the fact that in the Midwest, which we think of like our prime agricultural area where we're growing corn and soybeans, most of that production doesn't go to human food. I think only 6% of it feeds humans. Most of it goes to feed livestock, which then in turn feed humans, but 30% of it goes to ethanol. So there's issues there in the messaging. The distribution point is valid right now with COVID-19, right? We have all these people want food, their shelves are empty, food bank lines are long, but in other places of the country, they're dumping milk, they're letting crops rot in the fields. Right? It's the distribution that's always been the problem, not the quantity. So I don't think defending GMO based on its ability to increase yields is valid. I mean, I think that's true marketing. And in any advertising you see, you'll notice that idea of feeding the world comes up more and more.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, in conversations with close friends, which I typically try to avoid if I know that our thought processes, our paradigms aren't lining up, I still hear that from them. And I still hear that basically they believe that this food is feeding the world and there's nothing wrong with it, and that the propaganda from the organic side is that all this stuff is bad. To change the subject a little bit, one thing that's sticking out in my mind that we touched on very briefly in the last time we spoke on the podcast was the different chemicals in farming sprayed on fruits. And I specifically remember working with some farmers in Central Washington, and they had some nerve damage. They couldn't feel their hands, and they were working in cherry and apple orchards. So I was curious if you know what chemicals they might be using or might have been using, and what are the harms there potentially to consumers if they're eating non-organic fruits?
I don't know. I, as a vegetable grower, I'm not up on all of the fruit-based chemicals. I mean, you're basically mostly dealing with insecticides. The issue with fruit is that a lot of grocery stores mandate that fruit is sprayed with insecticides, because the last thing they want are fruit flies in the produce section. So whether or not a crop has insects on it or pest pressure, you're not even waiting to see if there's significant pest pressure that warrants being sprayed. You have a blanket mandate that you are spraying every fruit with an insecticide to preventively manage insects. And I think that's why it's such a big deal with fruit, that all of it gets sprayed basically if it's not organic. I grew up in a town where we had, you know, an apple orchard, and I don't know, I guess there's a history of farmers who handle chemicals dying young, even though chemical companies say they're harmless. And, you know, is it proven? No, but if you read between the lines, it sure seems like a lot of farmers who handle chemicals end up with serious medical conditions. And I think other farmers are picking up on that, but I think that's how they learn. Kind of back to my introductory point of, you know, farmers aren't going to probably stop using chemicals because some organic advocate yells at them that they're using chemicals. But if they see their neighbor have health issues, or even if they just see their neighbor stop using chemicals and start to have success in it, that's what's going to move the needle for them. And so kind of back, I think I mentioned this in the last podcast, there, you know, there's farmers out there like Gabe Brown in North Dakota who are kind of leading the way, showing how to do, you know, large scale agriculture, not just kind of a boutique organic farms, but we're talking thousands of acres of large scale agriculture using holistic practices. Where things are improving to the point that he doesn't need, his goal wasn't to go organic, but what he's finding is he doesn't, when he farms with the ecosystem holistically, he's finding he doesn't need to use the chemicals. And I think that's what's really starting to create change in this country. And I think it's coming from the ground up, right? Farmers are learning from other farmers. The research at the end of the day is probably not going to matter. The criticism is not going to matter. It's going to be, oftentimes it comes down to financial. The thing that gets farmers to stop using chemicals is simply how expensive they are, right? They're not committed to those chemicals. If they can keep the farm in the family not using chemicals, you know, and someone shows them how to do that, then they're going to be happy to go that approach. So I do think there's hope. With that, I know that kind of got off your topic of fruit chemicals, but
no, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, because in the end, it's about the farmer's health, the farmer's physical and mental health, and all that's connected, as well as the health of the soil, as we mentioned last time we talked, and the health of the product, the produce that they're growing, and, you know, are they financially healthy? Are they able to, as you say, pass on their farm to their family, or be able to make a profit every year? And, you know, what we were seeing and what we were talking about last time we spoke was the lack of profitability of the GMO model, because they're having to buy seeds every year. They're having to buy chemicals for those monocrops. And a lot of that money that's changing hands is ending up back in the big corporations' pockets, but not in the farmers' pockets. And
yeah, that's how agriculture's always been. But
yeah,
but not to interrupt, but what you said just spurred an idea, which is also in America, consumers have grown to think food has to be perfect looking, no blemishes, right? Whether how we got there, I don't know, or maybe we've been trained to get there. But how do you get perfect looking food? Typically, right? You're using chemicals to keep all the insects off of it. And so if you're a fruit grower, maybe you want to grow without chemicals, but if you're not allowed to sell into your local fruit cooperative because they're mandating certain quality standards and no blemishes, and they don't want fruit flies, and you can't sell it otherwise, right? You're being forced basically to use chemicals. It may not be what you want to do, but you don't really have many options. And so again, just kind of pointing out that nuance that like, farmers who use chemicals aren't always doing it because that's what they want to do, right? Sometimes it's consumers that are driving that. And so, you know, maybe that plays a role, right? Maybe consumers need to stop wanting perfection in everything. Maybe, I mean, we know that blemished food tends to actually be more nutritious because when plants are under attack from insects or disease, they produce all sorts of antioxidants that fight off that insect pressure, right? And so the food from those plants actually has more nutrition in it than a plant that grew with basically no threats to ward off. And so our consumerism is sort of undermining our health in a way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me because, you know, we basically have been taught the same thing in Western herbal medicine is that if you make a plant, if you grow a plant under certain circumstances and you don't pamper it too much and you let it survive the very hot summer and then those, you know, colder days in the fall before you harvest the root, it's going to have more of the phytochemistry that you're looking for, that profile that you're looking for under more stress. Whereas, as you say, if it's, you know, there's chemicals or if there's, you know, you're basically hovering over the plant all the time. It's kind of like what I think about like the helicopter parenting, but helicopter like farming, if you will, is not giving us the rich nutrients that we need. And you basically let me know recently that in Flathead County, there's a boron deficiency and a lot of trace mineral deficiencies in the topsoils across the U.S., specifically boron in Flathead County. Do you want to talk more about topsoil chemistry, soil science, and how that plays a role into our health?
Yeah. Well, if you're an organic farmer, like a certified organic farmer, the basic concept has always been that soil, right? You are managing the crop. Healthy soil grows a healthy plant, and either an animal feeds on that plant or that animal is us as humans. So healthy soil equals healthy plants equals healthy people. And it's not magic. You can't skip any of those steps. But sometimes we get high and mighty and we want to just say that organic is always better and more nutritious. And that can be an overreach. Organic does not have harmful chemicals on it. That's for sure. But is organic food more nutritious than other food? That all depends. That all depends on the soil in which it's grown in. And is it a naturally rich soil, or is the farmer taking steps to mineralize that soil, or has the farming that's taken place been rather extractive and has kind of mined off those minerals through harvests over the years and the soil gets depleted? And we have studies in this country where, you know, farms that have been in existence for a long time, I believe the case was with broccoli, there was 40% less nutrients in the head of broccoli today off of a single farm than it was years ago off of the same farm. So we're seeing a decline in nutrition coming from the soil. We like to talk about local and the importance of local, and I agree with that. But it's interesting to think about eating locally when you live in a place that has mineral deficiencies, right? Boron's super important, but if I decided to just eat off of my farm and I haven't supplemented the soil with boron, right? My soil is deficient in boron. My plants are deficient in boron, and there's symptoms that we find all the time from that, you know, where we know we need to correct. And then I, as a consumer, am going to be deficient in boron, right? Unless I'm getting it from somewhere else. So to think that like our diet somehow provides all of our necessary minerals that we need is not always true. It can be true, but I think it's important to know, right? Even if I decide to eat off of my farm, that there's going to be some supplementation. I need either food high in boron from somewhere else, or I need to supplement. Just eating organic, local organic, isn't going to get me where I need to be. And so again, I come back to my idea. I don't like making blanket arguments about local's better, organic's better. It's like there's so much nuance in all of those, right? Local done right and organic done right certainly are better, but it's not a guarantee.
Yeah, thanks for saying that, because I remember all the bumper stickers and the water bottle stickers going out years ago and being more kind of in vogue in the early 2000s, late 1990s, and probably before that, you know, shop locally, buy local, buy organic. And I think it's still in people's minds who remember it, but maybe not as loud as it used to be. And it's now it's more, okay, buy organic, go to your farmer's market, which basically implies local. And if there's trace mineral deficiencies and you're not, you know, for example, avocados are higher in boron. You know, we don't, as far as I know, there's no avocado farms in Northwest Montana.
Not yet.
Yeah, maybe soon. but
another 100 years.
Yeah, another 100 years as things warm up a little bit more. You know, never know, right? Never say never. But maybe in Hawaii, you know, or Mexico, where people are growing avocados, and then people go to Costco and they get their avocados. And, you know, I sometimes have consumer guilt of, okay, well, I'm not always buying organic local or local, period, because I know that this crop doesn't grow locally. So I think that's a good point to make. And going back to what we were talking about before we hit record about people basically just talking about Roundup being the main issue. Do we have any research in how that affects soil science, or is there any kind of word of mouth going around in your circles of how these different chemicals are disrupting soil microbiome, if you will, the microbiome of the earth?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not what's often mentioned about Roundup, but Roundup is an antibiotic. It kills life. So that means your soil microbiology is harmed. I think Dr. Zach Bush and his farmer footprint is one of his projects. You know, that's what he's really trying to drive home, is it's not just that this chemical is on your food and harming you. It's harming the soil. And really, it's so important to understand that the gut microbiome that's in a human and the soil microbiome, it's the same thing, basically, right? The soil is to the planet what the gut microbiome is to a human, and how similar those are, and how we need to treat both of those, right? We just can't worry about human health without worrying about soil health. So much agriculture today, conventional industrial agriculture, just assumes the soil is dead. And it's just because they treat it that way, it becomes the self-fulfilling prophecy. It's why they add, they just treat soil as a growing media to hold their roots, and then they're going to add all the fertility that they need to grow a plant. But they're not growing that plant for nutrition. You know, they're just trying to get a final product out of it, right? So in an organic system, you're looking, you're trying to maximize the biodiversity in the soil. You're trying to maximize the mineralization for the nutrition. I just wanted to hit on, you brought up local and organic. And I think those two, I just wanted to mention it, those two are often pitted kind of against each other. Like, which one, if you had to choose, which one's more important? And I just want to point out that it depends what your goal is, because those are two very different things. Local is a question of economics, right? Do you want to support your neighbor? Do you want to keep money recirculating in your local economy? Or do you want that money to leave the state or maybe even leave the country, right? And by eating locally, you can help have a more vibrant landscape, a more vibrant community. But local says nothing about nutrition or chemical use, right? GMO corn is local if you live in Iowa or Illinois. Organic, on the other hand, is focusing on a lot of things, but primarily the absence of synthetic fertilizers and pesticides. And so from a health standpoint, if you're trying to avoid chemicals, right, you're thinking organic. If I'm concerned most about human health, I'm picking organic over local. But the best option, I would say, is both. You got to find local organic. And as I mentioned with soil, not all organic farms manage their soil the same way. There are plenty of large-scale industrial organic farms in this country, and they're not using synthetics, but maybe they're not putting the same care into the soil as a small farmer would, right? And that is kind of a blanket statement, because not all small farmers focus on their soil, but I think the tendency is that small farmers are more passionate about more things than just profit. And so I do advocate a lot, like in your own community, find farmers, small farmers using organic practices, because that's your best shot, I think, at getting the most value out of your food, getting the most nutrition out of your food. And I realize 85% of this country is now urban. That's easier said than done, but it does seem like farmers markets, even if you live in urban areas, farmers markets are booming. You know, farmers are driving in from great distances to get that food. I think that's worthwhile, right? We have to get over this idea that there's work out there by the Bio-Nutrient Food Association in Massachusetts, which is really fascinating because it's trying to develop a phone app that is a spectrometer that measures nutrition in food so that the average consumer could like point this device at food in the grocery store or at farmer's market, and it would tell you, much like a BRICS test, it would tell you the nutritional value. So if you're holding up two different heads of broccoli, one maybe is local organic, one is maybe California organic, maybe they're the same price, maybe California is a bit cheaper, but if you look at the nutrition, if the nutrition is double in the local broccoli, but it's only slightly more expensive, where's the value, right? It's the value, the nutritional value is in paying a little bit more for double the nutrition. But consumers don't have that tool right now. We just buy everything by the pound, right? We go in and we're like, how much is broccoli by the pound? It's like, well, what if we bought broccoli by the nutrient density, right? How would that revolutionize our food system?
Yeah, I like that comparison, nutrient density. And as a clinician, I'm always recommending my patients buy more nutrient dense food. And I think oftentimes that phrase is kind of lost on people and they don't really understand what you mean, especially if there's this kind of counterintuitiveness of, well, we're taking some supplements for the nutrients, now I can eat whatever I want, which is not the point either. Going back to topsoil health and people needing to supplement with maybe at least just some trace minerals to start with, probably, and until they can check their levels again or something. But also going back to your points about the BRICS score or the BRICS meter, can you define what that is for the audience and the listeners?
I don't know if I can accurately. It's a spectrometer where you basically, to use it, you have to crush a piece of fruit or a leafy green. You get the juice out of it. You put it into this little mini telescope looking device and it reads the soluble sugars and it has a scale in there. Every vegetable is different, but like a really kind of high quality carrot would have a BRICS reading of 11 and a decent nutrition carrot would have a BRICS of maybe 8. And there's tables out there for each food item that gives you the relative scale. And so it's a quick way for farmers, at least, to kind of see what's happening in their plant tissues. But again, it's not something that a consumer, I mean, I don't think the produce department at the local grocery would like it if you were walking around crushing all their leafy greens in a garlic press, you know, to use with your BRICS meter, your spectrometer. So again, if you could put the power, if the Bionutrient Food Association does succeed in having a phone-based spectrometer, you've just put so much power in the hands of any consumer, right? Because nutrient density gets thrown around as a buzzword by farmers all the time. But just because we're small farmers or we're organic farmers, that doesn't necessarily guarantee nutrient density, right? And maybe we have a better probability, but it's not a guarantee. I think it'd be super cool to hold farmers accountable by putting that power in the hand of the consumer, you know, where there's an objective measure of nutrient density. And then the farmer would know, right? You would know if you had to do better because you would be able to read it.
Yeah, I like that. I like that idea of having a smartphone app, going to the grocery store, pulling out the smartphone and scanning your carrots or your kale before you buy it and saying, oh, well, it looks really good. It's organic. Let's see what it actually is. And I think the future is bright there with using technology to empower consumers and give them more information. I mean, most people are spending hours on their phone anyway. Why not use it for something for their health besides just measuring how many steps they're taking and a couple of other things?
Right.
So that's exciting to me. And then, you know, as a practitioner, I could say, well, download this smartphone app. And when you go and buy your groceries at the farmer's market or during the growing season, or you go to the grocery store, you can use this app. And maybe they can also scan their packaged food and that could give them a contrast of, you know, basically zero to more nutrients in the fresh live foods that were recently live.
Well, it would do away with all the issues we have with marketing and spin and greenwashing, right? It's like suddenly none of that messaging matters if the consumer can see for themselves whether it's true or false, right? And I think that would be great for a food system.
Yeah, that would be spectacular. And I'm always for personal empowerment over government regulation of people. So I'm excited for that. And do they have an idea of when this will be released, or they're still in the very early stages?
Right now, They have a test device, and they have partnered with a bunch of different farms. Our farm just signed up. So they have an open source program. This summer, we've agreed to test two different crops, lettuce and carrots. And so what we'll do is 4 or 5 times throughout this growing season, we will harvest carrots and we'll take a soil sample.
So when is this smartphone app going to be released roughly, and what stage of development is it at right now?
Well, right now they're trying to build an open source program for the software to work off of. So they've partnered with a bunch of farms around the country, and we've actually signed up to be part of that program. So throughout this summer on our farm, we've picked 2 crops to work with, carrots and lettuce. And so every month of the growing season, we're going to harvest. So we'll harvest carrots, and then we'll take a soil sample right next to that carrot, and we'll send it back to them, and they will do chemical analysis of the soil, tissue sample of the carrot. I think they're also going to look at the biology of the soil, and it's all open source. So as they get a baseline for their software to develop it, but also the farmers who are involved get all of that data back, not just for our own farm, but for all the farms. And so we can actually see, like, where are the most nutritious carrots coming from? What type of soil? What are the mineral levels? And so it's really exciting that while we're helping them develop it, we're also getting all this access to information to help us do a better job. And so that's where they're at. I don't know what the time frame is to have the technology out there. They're still developing it. I think they're optimistic that they're going to make it happen. But I don't know specifics beyond that.
That's very exciting. I'm excited to see what you learn and how this changes things for your farm and the other farmers. Do you have any idea how many farms they've contracted with or are working with on this?
I think it's the numbers in the hundreds. I don't know if it's in the thousands, but it's a pretty big undertaking for them. I mean, they're basically sending us all of the material up front, the sampling pouches, all the forms, prepaid postage to all these different farms. And then once a month, we're basically just pulling the samples, pulling the soil, mailing it back. And then they have to do all that lab analysis at no cost to the farmer. So it's a pretty big effort.
That's spectacular. And what company or university is this out of again?
It's not out. It's a nonprofit. It's called the Bionutrient Food Association. And okay. It's started by Dan Kittredge, who grew up in New England as an organic farmer. His parents were both heavily involved in forming Northeast Organic Farming Association, NOFA. You might recognize the acronym.
Yep.
So he's been farming his whole life, and this was just something he got really involved in. They do an annual conference, I know, in the fall every year. And it's all about soil health and human health and kind of really getting into the issue of nutrient density in our food.
That's spectacular. I would be interested in going to that conference someday, maybe when coronavirus is over.
We were actually going to have him out as a guest speaker right when coronavirus hit. So he was actually going to come to the Flathead. That got canceled. But they do have a Bionutrient Food Association does have a website with a lot of great information on it.
Awesome. Well, I hope the listeners check that out. I will definitely check out their website and look into what they do more. And I think that could be a great resource for people to apply what we have been talking about today on the podcast. Going back to soil science, how much does a small farmer like yourself invest? And when I say invest, I don't mean financially, but invest as far as time and putting different things into the soil, such as compost or compost tea. how much is that part of what you do in cover cropping and stuff like that for your farm and your friends who farm? Is this a big thing today, or is this only a small percentage of people? And how much of that of your year is spent preparing the soil?
It really varies by the farm, and it's a personal decision. As I mentioned, you don't get paid for the nutrition in your food. You get paid by the pounds. And so a lot of small farmers who are really passionate about the human health part of it, we're doing all of this knowing that we're not getting compensated for it, but we do it because we think it's the right thing to do, right? So if you want to talk about an alternate model compared to the corporate food system, that's it in a nutshell, right? They're doing everything for profit. We're trying to do the right thing. We spend a ton of effort, a ton of money on cover crop seeds, right? They never get harvested. We grow a crop, sometimes up to 10 different species in a crop, and it gets turned right back into the soil, mowed into the soil, just to be food and nutrients for the microbiome. We add amendments. I mean, it really is all about the soil at the end of the day. You know, that's where our effort is. In Montana, it's tricky because just right now, we're kind of entering the phase where we can really do anything in the fields. The fields are just starting to dry out. But throughout the growing season, from now until November, that's constantly what we're trying to do. Most of the amendments are either in the spring before we grow a crop, or in the fall when we pull our crops out, we're doing a lot of amendments then, so that we're prepared for the following spring. But I think it's why it's important to, you know, in every community, talk to farmers, ask lots of questions. There's no guarantee, you know, that one farmer or all farmers are doing something. You know, get to know your farmer, ask them questions about it. You'll kind of learn, you know, who are just trying to pull off a marketable crop, who are maybe putting a little bit more work into it, focusing more on nutrient density. You know, just a few specific questions, you can get at that pretty easily.
Thanks for that answer. That's really helpful. And it seems like that would be a relatively easy conversation to have with farmers at farmers markets, or if there are any other social gatherings that you can meet farmers at in your town, maybe run into them in your neighborhood or something when they're not busy farming. Are there any other organizations that people should look into to educate themselves that are maybe nonprofit and educational for the general public to get more information about some of the things we've been talking about? You mentioned Zach Bush MD's project. Besides his project, are there any other websites that usually recommend people go to learn more?
That's a tough one, because I know we live in the age of information overload, right? And really, we're only talking about a few basic ideas. I think it's more not getting more information, but more putting your information into practice, right? And strengthening those habits of how you think about food, and are you reading labels, and are you looking at seals of approval, like are you looking for the USD or organic? Just because you walk into a health food store, it does not mean everything in there is organic or better for you, although I think that is often the assumption. Many health food stores are just selling conventional processed food. Maybe they have fancier names. So I don't think we need to know more. We just need to do better. Read the labels, look for the word organic, look for the seal. I know there's the non-GMO verified seal, which is a new one. I think that confuses some people. It's on lots of packaging. It means there's no GMO products. It does not mean it's organic, right? It can still be conventional. It can still have chemicals in it. It just means it didn't come from a GMO seed. So kind of understanding what the labels mean or what they don't mean. You know, if you see the label natural, you can pretty much dismiss that it probably means nothing. I would say the USDA organic label is the most rigorous label to this day. That's not to say there aren't some issues popping up even with that, as there's a lot of industry pressure to water down the standards. You know, the inclusion of hydroponics and animal welfare continue to be issues within the organic label. But as a consumer, there's still the guarantee that there's no synthetic chemical residues on your food.
Gotcha. Yeah, I like that approach of being more action oriented instead of consuming more information. And
I feel like there's a limit to how much information, you know, how much do you need to make a good decision? And oftentimes people still won't make good decisions, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There, I mean, there's definitely that personality who they read all the things and they watch all the maybe wrong or right documentaries, depending on where you stand on different issues, and they know everything, but they're still doing all the same old things. So action is, you know, putting your feet down and moving in the right direction is key, with especially with food and lifestyle. I mean, you can read a book about exercise and not exercise. You can read a book about organic foods and labels and still eat fast food. And people still are going to McDonald's, you know, in Flathead County, McDonald's still open during coronavirus. So, which is really a whole other ball of wax, but yeah, I thought this was a really, really great interview, and I'm glad that you were able to set aside time. I know you're very busy with your farm and your life, so I wanted to thank you for your time. Do you have any parting comments or things you want to add?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground with what we talked about, and I appreciate you having me back on.
Awesome. Great. Well, thank you so much, Todd. And everybody can go check out your website, Two Bear Farm, and you're on Instagram.
Yeah, at Two Bear Farm, spelled out.
Awesome.
That's pretty much, that's where we focus most of our photos and info.
Spectacular. And when will you guys start? I know you're planting soon and all that, and the growing season is starting. When do you start doing farmers markets in Flathead County?
Usually that would be first one starts early May and two others come on late May. Hard to say what's going to happen this year with social distancing. It sounds like they're going to happen, although I'm sure it'll be very different. I don't know if attendance will be up or down. So there's a lot of logistics that we're working with. We're definitely for farms that do CSA shares, you know, pre-packaged boxes, that's proving to be a very good system to have for coronavirus, because it's easy. You don't have to stand in line. You don't have to, you just grab your box and go. So we're definitely changing what we're doing. We're doing a lot more CSAs this year than we typically would, just because we don't know what the market's going to be like. But we're still growing the same amount of food. We're going to get the food out into the community. The specifics of how we do that are yet to be determined.
Great. Well, thanks for doing that. And folks, if you're not signed up with the CSA, you probably want to look into if there's a CSA near you. If you're not in Flathead County, you're in another part of the country, and look into community supportive agriculture. Well, again, thanks so much. And until next time, everybody, please share the podcast with friends and family. People need this information. And more importantly, as we discussed, put it into action, because if you just consume information, you're not going to really get the benefits in your health and see those manifest the way that you're looking for. Thanks so much. Now, here's for my mandatory disclaimer. This is a medical information podcast and is only for general information purposes. It does not substitute or constitute the practice of medicine or any medical practices, including the giving of medical advice to any individual. And please observe that no doctor-patient relationship has been formed here.
This medical podcast offers health, hormone, fitness, and nutrition information and is designed for educational purposes only. You should not rely on this information as a substitution for, nor does it replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have any concerns or questions about your health, you should always consult with a physician or other healthcare professional. Do not disregard, avoid, or delay obtaining medical or health-related advice and appropriate treatment from your healthcare professional. Users should seek the care of their physician or healthcare professional for any such conditions. The use of any information provided on this podcast is solely at your own risk. The contents and topics of this podcast have not been evaluated by the FDA nor approved by any other government or official body. The topics and content covered is not intended to diagnose, cure, or prevent any disease or disorder of any kind. Developments in medical research may impact the health, fitness, and nutritional advice that appears here on the podcast in the future episodes. No assurance can be given that the advice contained in this podcast will always include the most recent findings or developments in medicine with respect to the particular material covered. If you are in the United States and think you are having a medical or health emergency, call your healthcare professional or 911 immediately. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to hearing your feedback and looking forward to have you on future podcasts. Thank you.